As I heard this beautiful song, I couldn't help but think of our situation which we have in Latin America, where there is such a preoccupation with death, and where Good Friday is celebrated to the exclusion almost of Easter Sunday. And I'm so glad that here in the United States of America, we have an opportunity to express our joy in the Lord. It's not just a morbid thing. We never leave Christ in the tomb. But we who are Christians always think of him as the risen Lord in this country, and I'm so glad for that, for the opportunities that we have to rejoice. In fact, that even death of a loved one is not so morbid and sad with us who know the living Christ. It is a great privilege and honor to have a background like this. For in Latin America, where the people shroud themselves in black for days and months and years following the death of a loved one, and where the preoccupation with death is so great, even though the death rate is extremely high, we find a morbidness which we sort of shed when we cross the borders and come back into this wonderful country, and we praise the Lord and thank him from the depths of our hearts for the opportunity to have a background of joy in the Lord such as we know here. I would like also to bring you greeting from Southern Baptist young people who are training for the missionary field in Latin America. I have during the past few years, had the opportunity to study in a language school in San Jose, Costa Rica. And some of you may have friends and loved ones who are there studying, because practically all of the missionaries who go out to Latin America do study there. And when the notice of this meeting came out in some of your magazines, many of the students came to me and said, we wish we could go with you. We wish that we could go in your suitcase and be in that wonderful meeting in Houston. And they almost envied me as much as is possible for a Christian, you know. And so so I bring you greetings from your splendid young people. I know several of them personally, and I don't want to mention one for fear of excluding another. But I have met a number of your wonderful, wonderful young people, and I admire and appreciate your work in missions very, very much. We have, of course, in the language school in Costa Rica, a marvelous opportunity of meeting and associating with young people of all denominations. And it is a priceless opportunity, for we get to know one another and understand each other's goals and realize that although there may be parallel lines, we're going in the same direction. And in Costa Rica and in Latin America, as I have found it, we are appointed to Central America as a whole, traveling in Sunday school work. And as I have found it so far in Central America, there is not so much difference between the denominations as we have here. This is a glorious thing, for there's very little extreme liberalism or modernism. But all of the Protestants are called evangelicals. Down there, you're either Catholic or evangelical. And that term does fit. Because the people who are evangelical in spirit are the ones who are sending out missionaries. And therefore we have marvelous fellowship, for which we give praise to the Lord. Declare his glory among the heathen, his wonders among all people. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the nations are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Declare his glory, his wonders, among all people. Now, the way I believe in missionary work perhaps is a little bit different from what some of you have understood. I know, of course, that you have a tremendously balanced goal. I have seen this morning, and I have had the opportunity of communicating in various ways with people of your group for years. And I have the highest respect for your balanced program. I think that everything in this world must be balanced, or it isn't any good, from the human mind, of course, to the wheel on the car. Everything has to be balanced, or we have trouble. And if we think of foreign missions to the exclusion of home missions, of course, we never really accomplish our purpose. But you have a tremendous home missions program. Also, as one of our speakers said this morning, missions begin in the home. And I believe this, and I believe also that sometimes we have a tendency to use the scriptures symbolically more than we do literally or historically in some cases. And there are those who think that being a foreign missionary is a little bit more glamorous and well, it's a little higher status, perhaps, in Christian service. Certainly not economically, but in Christian service, it's a higher status than working in your own neighborhood. And I have known people who've done splendid missionary service in their own neighborhood who felt just a little guilty. And they would hear missionaries talk about the problems on the field, and even in Latin America, in the capital city where we live, where we do not actually suffer for anything while we're in the city, we have many, many problems. And some people talk about these and say, oh, the old rich materialistic people that live in the United States don't understand. They just can't appreciate their opportunities. And it comes to the place where sincere Christians who live in this country sometimes get guilty. They think, oh, I have so much, and some of the missionaries suffer, and I wish I could do more for the Lord. Well, the truth of the matter is, it takes all sorts of Christians to carry forth the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ. And I do not envy any person living in the United States or having all of the honors and privileges and material pleasures and possessions that is possible for you to have under Christ, under God. I believe that we need people who live in good neighborhoods and have good homes and drive good cars because they have to witness to others. And you couldn't possibly win the average businessman of the United States if you lived in a little grass hut and ate like the missionaries. All you would attract would be newspaper reporters. And so, you see, it takes all sorts of people to win the world. And as Christ said, the field is the world. And it doesn't mean that there's any one place more important than any other place. As I was a little child, I didn't live in a, quote, heathen land, but I had an opportunity to live in a family situation which has prepared me for the work that we have today. When we began our idea of going to the mission field, it was for the specific purpose of specialized service in the field of Sunday school, for that has been our work ever since before we were married. My husband and I have been interested in Christian education and Sunday school work, and we've traveled in all of the states here helping to organize vacation Bible schools, teacher training seminars, camps, and Sunday school programs in all of the states, in missionary churches, and also established churches. And we began to see the tremendous need in Latin America, how they have so little of that sort of thing being done among any people, any denomination. And so we decided that under God, we would like to do that. So that is why we went over a year ago to Latin America. And my husband said, well, we're getting along in years now, and maybe we're too old to start on something new. We have to learn an entirely new language, and we really aren't qualified, because we had thought that, you know, missionaries wore white jungle hats and trampled through the swamps killing alligators, and we felt like we weren't very qualified. But then we look back over our lives, and we believe that the calling of God is the experience and education, opportunity that He has given you. You fit somewhere better than you fit anywhere else, and the calling that you will receive upon your life, more likely than not, will not come from a voice in the sky, but will be the development out of your natural way of life. You will be able to use your background, your experience, your education, your culture in some way. And we felt like that our opportunities that we had as children, of course, my husband comes from an entirely different sort of home from mine, but the two of us then had a combined experience which we felt would be appropriate for this work, and we have found it so. For the conditions in Latin America, in many cases, in the country areas, and among the Indians who live like they did before Columbus came, we find situations that would be shocking to many persons. And people who are as old as we are and have always lived under more or less comfortable circumstances perhaps wouldn't be able to adjust rapidly to such a situation. But to us it is nothing. In every child I see a picture of myself. And I when I see them dirty and naked and ragged and sometimes crawling with lice, I do not think, isn't this a horrible situation? It's bound to lead to juvenile delinquency, and get shocked and too impressed by all of this to be of any use, either with sympathy or shock. But I see them as they are. I think and recognize in each little child a tremendous potential, because I had an opportunity, as I was a child, to be in a different situation from that which most of you understand today. And I believe that these experiences are for a purpose. Whereas I would not say that I believe in strict predestination. I mean, one person to heaven and another one to hell, I don't know. But I think that there is a way, a destiny, for every living human. That God has a reason for you, and He has raised you up for a certain purpose and has placed you in the situation where you are today. And if you feel a tug of the Spirit that cannot be denied, that you should give your life to some sort of foreign service, that's fine. But don't ever think that that's the only place that you might work in God's great white harvest field, which is the world. Now, when I was a child, I was born into a family of people who moved from one place to another constantly. And nowadays they have very fine words for these people who move, who follow the crops and so forth. I think they call them the migrant workers. That's a rather high-sounding term. And I once was asked to discuss the problems of the migrant child to an international conference of government labor officials. And the gentleman from California rose to his feet and said, "We no longer call them migrants in California. That word has fallen into disrepute. It has bad connotations. We call them the non-local temporary domestics." So, we've developed by watching television, I suppose, rather a good vocabulary in these days. But when I was a child, they hadn't thought of those high-sounding terms, and they called us bums or hobos. We drifted from one place to another, making our living in whatever method was available, usually picking the fruit or the cotton in season. And then between the crops, we would sell baskets made from willows, which Dad would gather along the riverbank. And Mother made crepe paper roses, and my job as the eldest child in the family was to sell these baskets and flowers along the streets. So I had an opportunity that many individuals never have, to look at a town more or less objectively, to see what made it, to see why it was there. And I had a picture of the United States of America, and of its institutions and its people, that escapes the average person who takes everything for granted because he lives in a certain place. And I'd like to tell you how I think these experiences touch upon the subject of missionary work. You see, as we travel from place to place, going from one town to another constantly, we never claimed a hometown. My parents were what I call true vagabonds. Now, there are some ideas that being a vagabond is romantic, interesting, and there is that aspect, of course. But there are many parts about it that are very bad. For one thing, most of you wouldn't make very good vagabonds. You wouldn't make true bums. I can tell how. All I would have to do is say something of a derogatory nature about your state. If you're a Texan, if I say something of a derogatory nature about the great state of Texas, you start to bristle. That means you'd never make a real good bum. You see, a bum doesn't care. One place is as good as another. My dad never claimed a hometown. And this leads to a bitterness against society, a feeling of not belonging. And you don't think you belong anywhere, and pretty soon it becomes a bitterness. And in the hobo jungle, poverty wasn't so bad. I mean, we had a tremendous, unbelievable poverty to the point of many days not having anything to eat, and knowing of children who starved to death, seeing them lying there in their tents with their little swollen stomachs. And yet, even though there was this poverty, the worst thing was the demoralized condition of the spirit. Many people have lived through poverty, and they've had a poor, swept clean sort of existence where there was great character development. But in the hobo jungle, as I knew it, there was none of this. The people were demoralized. And I would hear them as they sat about the fires at night, whittling sticks down to little points to pick their teeth. And they talked about the old crooked government, full of graft, and the nasty, nice, high society, rich people that lived in houses, kick you in the teeth, push you down. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and what's the use? You're just what you were born to be, that's all. What's the use? And so demoralized, they sat by the fire and spit their snuff and didn't try to do anything about it. I realize that that demoralized idea is prevalent in the world today, not only among hobos, but among people, as I used to say, who live in houses also. And not long ago, there was a popular song in which, in this ballad, I believe a child came to its mother and said, "Will I be handsome? Will I be rich?" And the mother answered in this terribly dogmatic and overly simplified fashion, "Whatever will be, will be." Well, now, that's the demoralized, fatalistic idea. Whatever will be, will be. But it's not logical. Supposing the little guy really believed this, if it didn't make any difference to his looks anyway, if he were going to be handsome or ugly one way or another, it didn't matter, what's the use of washing his face? And as he grows a little older, why should he bother to shave or get a haircut or take a bath or use a deodorant? And you can imagine what's going to be. You see, we don't just sit down in the middle of things and let happen whatever's going to be. Most of us try to make some sort of improvement upon nature. Some women go a long way. But we think there's something we can do about it. And I believe that that is what I called when I was a child, or when I look back upon my childhood days, the God quest. As a child, I just said, I wish I wasn't a bum. I'd like to be something better than I am. That's the way I put it. I wish that I could be like the real people who live in houses. I don't know what I thought I was. I call them real people. I suppose I thought I was a lower form that hadn't yet evolved. But these real people lived in houses, and they looked so different from the hobo children, the camper kids. And I said, I don't like this. Now, why didn't I like that? Why didn't I just relax and become a part of my environment? You know, the primary group environment is supposed to be all-powerful. But I didn't like it. And in spite of the poverty and the demoralized philosophy of these bums, I wanted to be, as I said, something better than I am. And I call that the God quest. The urge within an individual to find his reason for being, to be the best that is within him to become. And consciously or unconsciously, this exists, I believe, in every living creature. And that is what gives us greater hope as we look at the mission fields. We realize that there is tremendous potential. And the old idea of a missionary going in and setting himself up as a little white godfather doesn't work. We must see the indigenous church plan, the idea of drawing forth the best potential from those wherever we find them. And as I traveled about, I found people who saw potential in me. And I call this education. I think that education in its various phases is the greatest function of mankind. Now, let me tell you what I mean by that. Education is the drawing forth of potential, the recognition and drawing forth of potential. It begins in the home. The mother sees potential. She becomes the educator. Sometimes she sees some that isn't even there. And does her best to draw forth from this child the best that is within him. Now that is true education. The minister does this. And the Sunday school teacher. And the good neighbor. And the school teacher. We have a great deal of criticism about our public schools today. But in my experience, though I don't have time to go into it today, in my experience, I found tremendous, tremendous opportunities in our free public schools. And I have had an opportunity in the past 5 or 6 years of visiting schools in every state. And I realize that in spite of a few things that definitely need improvement, our boys and girls have a marvelous opportunity to develop according to their individual potential. If you as parents will stand behind them and help them to choose the courses which are proper for their own potential. I believe in a person developing according to his own potential. Because I think this is his God-given right and duty, not to try to be something he's not equipped for, but to develop according to his own God-given potential. And there he will find serenity and peace, and he won't be maladjusted or have a nervous breakdown. It's because we're out of our place for being, we're kicking against the pricks, that we have so much nervousness and anxiety, I believe. And so we need to each one of us try to fit in our place where God meant for us to be. And as I looked along the streets of an ordinary American town, I began to see something that many people miss. You know, today it's quite cynical to say that everything is caused because of an economic motive. They say, oh, this country was established not so that people could worship according to their own conscience, but because of an economic motive. Economic motivation rules the world. But do you know what I discovered when I walked into an ordinary American town? I discovered that even though this town became situated here because of an economic motive, maybe for water transportation or gold or iron or coal, this town did not live upon those things alone. No people was ever satisfied to exist there upon gold or iron or coal. But in every case, they built churches and schoolhouses and libraries. They tried to do something that wasn't just economic and material. And not belonging to a certain town, I could see that. I could walk in, and I went all along the streets, going into every place of business and knocking at the door of every house asking, would you like to buy a basket today? They're 25 cents apiece. And there I had the opportunity to observe how the real people lived. And I saw that there were houses and stores and factories. But I said, what are these buildings that are not houses? The prettiest buildings in town. And a lady told me, oh, public building. She said, that one happens to be a library. And I said, a library? What's a library? What do they do with it? Who owns it? How much does it cost to go in? See what I mean, objective. Well, she said it was a free public library. Now, I you know, was a bum, and a bum soon learns to take advantage of whatever is free. Now, the sad part about it is that many individuals who live within sight of a library never get that wise. They let the free things go to waste. And I think that's one of the great tragic factors in our country today. You hear people talking about never having an opportunity to get an education, and they never bother to enter the church and the library, which two institutions along all the streets of our cities and towns contain the culture and wisdom of all the ages. And all you have to do is walk in and accept it. And so I walked into a library, and nobody kicked me in the teeth. I looked at books and pictures and sat at a polished table. I called everything that was smooth and clean, the clean, smooth things, the clean, smooth people, the clean, smooth houses. Well, you can understand why I liked anything that was clean and smooth, because everything we had was dirty and wrinkled. And then we seldom had a second outfit of clothing. And we didn't have another outfit that we saved for the dark hours. When it was night, we rolled up in an old piece of canvas or quilt and went to sleep under a tree. When it was morning, we unrolled and went about our business. We didn't have any of this tiresome routine of getting all changed into a completely different set of garments and waiting for your turn at the bathroom. Life did have its advantages, I said. On the other hand, you can understand the contrast which I made to the brushed, polished, starched, iron, clean, smooth people who live in houses. And then, too, in the hobo jungle, we had this not only embittered philosophy, but also our reason for being was questionable. What did we do for life anyway? What was the sense of it? Well, we sold a basket for a quarter, and with the quarter we bought beans. And we cooked the beans in a big black kettle on the campfire, and we ate the beans in order to get strength enough to go out and sell another basket to get another quarter to buy some more beans. And what was life but a pot of beans? Now, this to me is genuine materialism. I hear people talking about the materialistic United States. Well, the truth of the matter is, if you have an economic position that's comfortable enough, you have an opportunity to turn your mind to other things that are not materialistic. To me, the most materialistic thing in the world is a situation we find in Latin America where people grovel the whole day long to try to get enough to eat or just go out and beg on the streets. The whole mind is on beans. And that's what I knew in the hobo jungle, just living to live, to survive, to fill that kettle. But here along the streets of a town I found a library. And what did that have to do with beans? There must be another dimension to life, something that I didn't understand. And so I went to the library and I found an art gallery and a museum and a city park and a zoo. Beautiful, lovely things that must mean something else besides making a living. Of course, I would discover the beautiful churches. And so one day I said to somebody, what are they? Are they public? Well, something like that. Could I go into one like I do the library? Oh, I suppose they're always trying to get people to go into churches. But my mother told me they'd laugh at me. So all the old rich people just go there to show off their pretty clothes. But one day we camped near a small town, and we used to camp along the river, you know, under the bridge if we could. In those days, you could drive your old jalopy down off the road, right down to the riverbank quite often. And the bridge gave us shelter, and trees were usually there, and there was water in the river to wash. And so we camped under a bridge. This Sunday morning, I looked up on the bridge, and I saw some little children, all clean and smooth and brushed and polished and starched and ironed, going across the little bridge into the small town. I said to my mother, where are they going? She said, oh, I suppose Sunday school. And I said, is that church? And she said, well, yes, something like that. Well, Mama, could I go? Is it free like the library? Oh, she said, I suppose it doesn't cost anything. But they'd laugh at you. I told you, they'd just laugh at you. You'd be sorry. And I said, well, Mama, they never laughed at me at the library. And if it's free, I want to go. And so I started out. Oh, first of all, I tried to clean up the best I could. We had washed some of our clothing, and it was spreading out on the bushes to dry, and I found something there to put on. And then, of course, one thing that I always disliked about the campers was they had such dirty elbows. Of course, we were outdoors a lot, and we were brown, and I saw the children who lived in houses. It seemed to me like they were so white and clean. Of course, some I hadn't seen up close. But anyway, I thought if I just could get my elbows clean, that maybe I wouldn't look so much like a bum. We seldom had any soap, but Dad said you didn't really need soap anyhow. The ashes were better. And so I got a handful of ashes from the cold campfire and took them down to the river and rubbed on my elbows. Now, you know, it will work if it doesn't take the skin off first. So I started out all alone in a strange town to follow the children down the road to a little white church. Now, I haven't any notion what kind of church that was. You can't understand this, but I had never heard in those days of any certain dogma or doctrine. I didn't know that churches had different brands. I just walked in. And my friends, no matter what kind of church it was, I'm certain that I couldn't say it all. I don't even know what town it was. I know when I sat in a polished pew and looked at the stained glass windows and listened to the music of the organ, something inside responded, and I felt sure there must be a life better than beans. There must be something else that made me want to reach, something finer and higher and more beautiful than I had ever known before. And so I saw some clean, smooth children, and I followed them to see what they would do, and they walked down some stairs into a basement room. And here it was like fairyland to me, a beautiful, beautiful place, with curtains at the windows, linoleum on the floor, pictures, books, music, flowers, and rows of little red chairs. Now some say to me, weren't you embarrassed? Not the way you understand it. You see, embarrassment, as you know it, is a product of your culture. I wasn't civilized enough to be embarrassed. Some of you watching the inaugural address of President Eisenhower may have seen a dog walk in front of the television camera. He wasn't embarrassed. You would have been very embarrassed in that position. But you see, I was like a little dog. I could just walk around and look at everything because I was used to the real people jostling me on every street corner. And so they didn't frighten me, and I didn't expect anybody to shake hands with me. After all, I was only a bum. And that's a genuine inferiority complex when you don't think you're a real person. But there's some advantages to it because you don't get your feelings hurt. So I sat in a little red chair and held onto the seat so nobody'd make me move. And nobody did. And a smiling lady showed pictures and told a wonderful story of a man called Jesus who loved all the children in the whole wide world and didn't care who they were or where they lived. Somebody loved me, one little hobo kid. Do you see how important this was? Out in the street, I was a dirty bum. But here, a teacher, an educator, if you please, saw in me potential. Out in the street, I was a bum. But here in the little red chair at Sunday school, I could be a very child of God. She saw that in us, that we were children of the living God, no matter who we were or where we lived. And that made everything different. It meant everything to me. Now let's look at this Sunday school room. Where are we now? Someplace in Kansas or Nebraska, perhaps? Maybe even in Texas, I don't remember. Somewhere in the Midwest or Southwest, where we used to travel. Sometimes we went so fast we didn't pay any attention to what state we were in. It didn't make any difference. You can't understand that either. But that's the psychology of a true vagabond. Anyway, where was I in this little church? And what sort of situation was this? I call it a mission field. And here some kind people had painted these chairs red. Now, you know, it wasn't a dogma nor an irrefutable doctrine of any kind which led me to appreciate and love this place and go back to Sunday school every time I had an opportunity. It was that little red chair. God knows children, and for that reason, He has inspired you sometimes to decorate your classrooms. And when you've hung curtains or polished the furniture, that was missionary work. And sometimes I think about the people who talk about the fads and the frills on the schoolhouse, and it irritates me. I will admit that little chair was functional, but also it was red. You don't have to take your choice. In fact, doctors tell us nowadays that strawberries are better for you than spinach. Contain more iron. But anyhow, or more usable iron anyway. The truth of the matter is, you don't have to take your choice between what is attractive, educational, religious, and pretty, and pleasant. And somebody had created this beautiful, beautiful place. After that, I found out some of the Sunday schools weren't as nice as others. And so, not being tied by any dogma, you see, or any denomination, I simply started out very early in the morning and shopped around. I inspected all of their basements, and if they didn't have any little red chairs, I wouldn't go there. But here stood a smiling teacher telling me the story of the Lord Jesus Christ, his love for little children. Where did she come from? Who was she? Let me tell you what I think. You know, sometimes we think of our town as our Jerusalem. And we say, we need to take the gospel first to Jerusalem. And then Judea, I suppose that's the state. And Samaria, maybe that's the rest of the United States. And then the uttermost part of the earth, that's India and China and Argentina. Well, it's all right to take it symbolically like that. But I think sometimes we should look at this historically, literally. And this is what I see. I see the Lord Jesus Christ as he stood there on the mountainside, talking for the last time to his disciples, recognizing that God had limited his work to these few human beings. And the death of Christ upon the tree now was in a position where it could be utterly forgotten and made of no effect if these few men did not obey the command of Christ. And trusting his very death upon the cross, all of his life and teaching to his disciples, he said, "Go and teach all nations." Everything that had been done up to this point, trusted to these few bits of clay. It makes me tremble. He said, take this gospel to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and the uttermost part of the earth. And the disciples went forth from there to become the apostles, to be martyred, to do, well, the job that was called turning the world upside down. And they accomplished their purpose so well that even those who do not claim to serve Christ number the days of their calendar according to his life and death. They turned the world upside down, these few lumps of human clay, because they had the responsibility. God had limited himself to them. And they went to Jerusalem, and they went to Judea, and they went to Samaria. And we know even in the Bible times, we know that the gospel was into Asia Minor. We don't know who told who, but somebody told somebody who told somebody, and finally it was spreading all over Europe. And somebody told somebody who told somebody, perhaps, who told Martin Luther, and he probably his mother, his family. And he then came in, and you know the tremendous history, but the point is somebody told him who had heard from somebody who had heard from somebody who had heard from somebody who had heard from Jesus Christ himself. And so it was a living line. And he preached, and somebody else heard, and they told somebody, and they told somebody. And they kept on telling one another until our ancestors, who are the original founders of our various denominations, heard this. And they carried it across the ocean to the New World. And somebody told somebody there, and they built little log churches, and they went out west, each one telling somebody else. Until finally, perhaps somewhere out in Kansas or Nebraska, some mother or Sunday school teacher or kind neighbor or friend told, we'll say, a little girl, and she grew up and became a Sunday school teacher. She brought fresh flowers to her class one Sunday morning. She had her lesson well prepared. Maybe she had a headache. Maybe she decided she wouldn't come today. Maybe she had company last night, and the sink full of dishes, and the kids with the mumps. And she said, "Oh dear, I just can't do it." But then she felt a constraining love of Christ. She went and stood before her class. She told the story of the man called Jesus who loved all children. And I heard that story. I heard that story from a missionary out here in the uttermost part of the earth. And according to God's great universal plan for the ages, we are out here today in the uttermost part. Through the years and over the miles, the story has come until literally we stand out here at the end of a living chain that reaches back to Christ. And that's what makes me tremble, makes me stand in awe to realize that I am connected in some human line that leads clear back to Jesus. And so are you. And you don't know who is in that line, what nationality or color or class or type. Who is in that line that kept it living until one day you heard the gospel? Not a one of you has ever been converted or become a Christian because you heard a voice or because you saw something written in the sky. And having never heard from human lips or read from anything that a man had ever written, you just accepted God for your own emotional experience. No, not a one of you. You are all here today because of some living human being, what they said or wrote. The Bible itself is limited to man, to his language, his symbol, his paper, his machine. We are, in a reverent, wonderful, awesome way, Christ, God, in our day, standing out here at the end of a living line that reaches back to Christ. And so I received it that day from that Sunday school teacher, and that's why I'm here. Many interesting experiences along the way, some sad and some funny. But nothing ever swerved me from that time until this, that I too had a responsibility. And I can reach back and just touch the hand of that Sunday school teacher and reach out and touch the hand of one of my little Latin neighbors and know that the potential is within him as surely as it ever was in me. If I can keep unbroken this living chain that reaches back to Christ.